You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. When it comes to the Sasquatch phenomena, following on from the main sighting encounters are numerous secondary experiences. Wood knocks, stone throwing, vocalizations, all become attributed to our hairy friend in the woods. But what if something else is going on? In his new book, The Forest Poltergeist, author W.T. Watson considers the possibilities of other Fortean sources for some of the other events that people experience in the woods alongside the flesh and blood Sasquatch. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patron, Sari, and to each and every one of you that continue to support the show. Thank you. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. Our intro and outro music is provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. What if something else other than the giants of the forest are responsible for some of these encounters with unseen forces? Let's try and find out. In the pantheon of Sasquatch encounters, there are a wide variety of events associated with them. From the sightings, we also have reports of stone throwing, wood knocks, calls, and more. For some, these all have a flesh and blood source. But in some cases, there's simply no sighting to clarify this. Could it be that there's more than one phenomenon at play here? In his new book, The Forest Poltergeist, W.T. Watson attempts to look at things with a fresh perspective. Travis, welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back, Paul. It's always a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. Thank you as well for chasing me down, because we had a bit of a strange. We had a supernatural disappearing email happen.
Yeah, well, I have had, oddly enough, since I've started doing the publicity for this book, I've had more than my share of weirdness happen as far as technology goes. It's been specifically technological stuff. Emails getting lost, audio going out, all kinds of weirdness. So it's been kind of interesting. I wonder if the poltergeists are like, ha ha, we got you now.
Well, this new book, as we were joking off air, Travis, is encompassing two of my very favourite subjects, because along with Bigfoot, I think the other Fortean phenomenon that I've always been obsessed with is the poltergeist, from as long as I've been interested in weird topics. And I think reading your book and knowing what I know, I've been a big believer for quite a while in the fact that, I don't know why this seems to occur, because for me, this book lands perfectly in some of the concepts that I've considered over the years in regards to certain encounters and certain reports that have come in. Because I don't know how people go from it being flesh and blood to, oh, well, it's interdimensional, and seemingly miss the elephant in the room here, that no one seems to be mentioning the supernatural properly.
Yeah, exactly. So just to back up a little bit, as we were discussing earlier, this book actually arises from conversations that I've had with other people involved in this research, and specifically a particular podcaster whom you'll see mentioned in the book, who, the thought was this: when you look at Sasquatch research, you very quickly discern that databases like the BFRO and those kinds of guys separate things into two different camps. There's what they call a Class A sighting, which is basically a visual sighting of a Sasquatch. And then you have these Class B encounters, where individuals in the wilderness encounter or have odd disturbances happen around them. And you mentioned some of those things, tree knocking or wood knocks, stone throwing, vocalizations, tracks, these strange structures that people report finding in the woods and all those things. And the Sasquatch researchers all look at this stuff, and because these things occur in territory that they associate with Sasquatch, just assume that that these phenomena are caused by Sasquatch. And they may well be. There may well be a physical cause for some of these encounters. As I've said over and over and over again on all of the interviews that I've done, I don't discount the possibility of there being a physical creature. I think there's a lot more going on, but I don't discount the idea that there may be a physical bipedal primate out there somewhere. I live in Canada. There are hundreds of thousands of square miles of wilderness here that you can hide just about anything in. So I don't discount that. But when you look at these Class B encounters and this wood knocking and stone throwing and all that kind of behavior, this particular person that I was talking to actually said to me, or and has said on the air, that if you took all of that stuff and you put it inside a house, you'd have a poltergeist case. And I said to him, wow, that's the, I had thought along those lines myself. I said, that's a really great idea. You're going to write something about this? And he says, oh, heck no, I don't have the time for it. So I said, do you mind if I write something about it? And he said, no, not at all. Go ahead. So I set out to look at these two phenomena together, the Class B seemingly Sasquatch encounters and the poltergeist phenomena. And I quickly discovered that there was so much material that I might end up writing one of those, 400 or 500 page Victorian type books where, you have case after case after case after case to illustrate stuff, right? Now, I'm known for writing pretty concise introductory books to particular phenomena. And that's what I wanted to do here. I didn't want to write a 2-volume set. But it was really, really difficult because there are, Sasquatch research encompasses a lot of territory. Even if you're just looking at the United States and Canada, there's literally thousands of sightings and thousands of these Class B encounters, right? And then when you start talking about poltergeists, there's lore going all the way back into the Middle Ages, and probably farther than that. I think the earliest ghost encounters that were recorded in like by Greek writers actually involved certain physical phenomena. So, and I can't recall the name of the fellow, but I think it was clanking chains or something.
Yes, in a haunted villa.
Yes, yeah, exactly. You know which case I'm talking about, I'm sure.
Yes.
My struggle in doing this book was trying to make it concise. And so I followed an outline of, okay, so these are some of the things that have been outlined. When the other I back up just a minute. The other thing that made it difficult for me to be concise is when you start discussing what might be producing poltergeist effects, which is also a part of this book. So I decided that what I would do is I take kind of an outline form, and I would write some chapters on things like wood knocks, on stone throwing, on these structures and so forth. And then, I would present the Sasquatch material, and then I would present poltergeist material that was, if not the same, then similar to,
yes,
to the material that we're seeing in Class B encounters. And the fact is, these things line up. There is nothing out there in the wilderness that people are encountering in these Class B encounters that couldn't be duplicated by the poltergeist phenomena. And that's the basic thrust of the book.
I mean, this is the thing as well, Travis. I think, as a fellow 14, I think you're a very similar mindset to myself in the fact that I like a variety of topics. And for me, I get really frustrated sometimes when I hear or see other cases, and it doesn't matter if we're talking about cryptids or UFOs or the Fae or poltergeists or whatever, you will always see people who are in their camp, and they, as far as they're concerned, everything is what they investigate or they're interested in. Anything to do with Bigfoot, if it goes off the path of a sighting or things that they think they can ascribe to the behavior of such creatures, they're not interested. Or if people see a report about a UFO and someone describes a creature in a certain way, they'll say, oh, well, that's got to be a fairy, then they're wrong. And I'm always frustrated that it doesn't seem to matter which area you come from. There are so many people who describe themselves as Fortians, where in essence they're not, because they are boxed in by their own belief structure, and therefore whatever they're investigating, they either don't care if anything in that report is outside of their parameters of their interest, or they will tell the witness that what they're describing didn't happen, and it, therefore it must be what they believe in.
Exactly. And I can't agree with you more, Paul. I mean, one of the things that I see in the Fortean or the, I guess, the paranormal community overall, is people not taking a Fortean viewpoint and looking at all of the different phenomena that are out there, but instead zeroing in and going into a silo on one particular thing and then making assumptions that they know what that thing is. Now, I'll give you a good example. Quite some time ago, I can't honestly remember how long ago it was, there was an outbreak of dogman sightings in Pennsylvania.
Mm.
And I, you know, not like, you know, like there were dozens of them or anything, but there were like two or three that happened in the Pennsylvania area. And I just on a lark contacted one of the investigators who had gone out to talk to the witness, right? Now, I'd read the witness report and the description of the creature and so forth, right? And this fellow assured me that this individual actually didn't see a dog man, that it was actually Sasquatch.
Yes.
And I did a little digging into this individual's background and found out that, lo and behold, they were a Sasquatch researcher. That's what they – that was their thing, right?
Mm.
I was like, well – the you know, so I wrote back and I said, well, the report that I've read says that, you know, this was a bipedal entity with a dog-like head and pointed ears and a snout. You know, that doesn't sound like a Sasquatch to me.
Mm.
And I got radio silence. I mean, there was no reply at that point. And this is just a good example. People get siloed into these ideas. Okay, you know, Sasquatch is a bipedal primate, and any large, dark, fur-covered thing seen in the woods must be a Sasquatch.
Mm.
Sorry, kids, but there's people seeing all kinds of weird crap in the woods.
Yes.
And, you know, not all of them are Sasquatches or even look like Sasquatches. I mean, if you looked at Canadian Monsters and Mysteries, there's a couple of really weird sightings of, you know, white things out in the woods.
Yeah.
That people weren't quite sure what the heck they were looking at. So, you know, when we look at these phenomena, these mysteries, I really feel that we need to take a Fortean perspective, and we need to look at all of the other mysteries out there and say, does this mystery look like that mystery? Could this mystery be associated with that mystery? I think that researchers in these areas need to be more widely read on all of the different weird stuff that is out there.
Mm.
So that, you know, so that the Sasquatch researcher who gets a report of strange lights in the forest doesn't freak out and throw the report away,
yeah,
you know, or pigeonhole it somewhere, or just not mention the anomalous lights. or the UFO researcher who goes out to investigate a UFO sighting, and the witness tells him that there is Sasquatch on the property, doesn't, you know, just forget that or stonewall it or, you know, throw it away or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this happens. It absolutely happens. The UFO investigator will go out and will report on the UFO and neglect to mention the Sasquatches, and the Sasquatch investigators will go out and will, you know, write up the Sasquatch and forget to mention the UFO. These are mysteries, folks. There's a reason they're called mysteries.
Yep.
You know, it's because we don't know what the heck we're dealing with. And so, you know, I'm very, very, very much agree with what you say, you know, that the people that are investigating these things need to take a wider view of what they're looking at. And they need to understand that it's not just one thing most of the time. You know, I mean, there may be times where it is one thing. But, yeah, I mean, you know, when you're talking about Sasquatch, for instance, I mean, these Class B encounters, I propose several different things that could be going on. You know, and I didn't run out of things to talk about. I just, you know, kind of narrowed it down for the sake of being concise. So totally agree with your view that people need to expand their horizons a little bit.
It is. And I mean, I've often said this because it's very quick when we deal with weird subjects and our love of such problems to the mind, as it were, Travis, I think it's very easy to kind of point fingers at the people who are skeptical and always give the sort of rational explanations for some which are frankly ludicrous in certain cases. And yet we don't seem to do the same when it comes to the other side of it, regardless of that. And that's always been a frustration for me, because the one thing I've learnt over the last 5 years is that there are as many strange and ludicrous explanations for weird things as there is on the skeptical side. And I think too often the skeptics get a hard fail from people in regards to this, and yet sometimes people will come out with the most ludicrous presumptions about a particular case, as you've just been explaining about the dogman sighting. I've heard that, I've seen that before from people claiming that whoever said they saw a dogman, they were completely wrong. It must be a Bigfoot. And that just shows you the bias once again of the kind of belief structure and bias that even though people claim to be open-minded, they aren't, because as far as they're concerned, it has to be this. It can't be anything else, because as far as they're concerned, it doesn't exist. Or they're not interested in it. And I think over the years of doing this show, the one thing I've realised and tried to be more positive in regards to is trying to have that kind of philosophy that John Keel had, and people like Tony Healy have, and somebody like Zelia Edgar or Chad Lewis, where you ask about everything. You don't just take on board, well, I saw this hairy thing and it was doing that. You find out, well, have you had anything strange happening at home? Has anybody else you know had something strange happening? Have you seen strange lights? Have you heard strange noises? Rather than just focus on what, because of the amount of times I've heard reports of people that have been uncovered where they say, oh, yeah, well, we told them about this other phenomenon, but they just simply weren't interested. And you think, we've got a strange thing going on here. And as you say in this book, you are not suggesting that there is no flesh and blood source to what people are seeing. This is running parallel. And I think too often for a lot of people, Travis, when we talk about strange phenomena, it's one thing or another. There's no cross-pollination of ideas, as you say. A lot of people are not widely read in any other Fortean field. I've often found it crazy that you can believe in hairy creatures running around North America and Australia and be completely dismissive about UFOs or poltergeists. It baffles me.
And again, I totally agree with you, Paul. This is a situation that I see. Well, okay, going back to this, you know, this dogman sighting, there are Sasquatch researchers out there that will tell you flat out there's no such thing. Now, I'm sorry, but there's a really, really good body of evidence for cryptid canids now, whether they're bipedal canids or, you know, some of these, I think Linda Godfrey called it the bear wolf.
Yes.
That, you know, seemed to be some kind of a large, almost prehistoric type wolf that Yeah, she tells a story of one fellow who's taking his wife to the hospital. I think they're having a baby, and this creature manifests out of the snow as they're making their way down this Wisconsin highway, and actually tries to bump their car off the road. This thing was huge,
Yeah.
you know, obviously was not a regular dog, right? And you see these kinds of things, and it's just it's baffling to me how you can believe that there is an upright bipedal primate living in the forests of North America and probably throughout the world, right? Because we get, you know, Yowies in Australia and Yetis in the
Yeah.
Himalayas and so forth, the Almas in Russia. We got all these different reports of these large bipedal primates, right? And, you know, there's this mystery around them, and nobody's been able to bring one in, and so on and so forth. And the people that investigate those things will flatly deny the fact that there may be ghosts, that there may be UFOs, that, you know, the poltergeist phenomena is real, or any of this stuff, because they think they're scientists, right? And they're looking for a lost species. Sorry, kids. If you really pay attention to what's going on in the Sasquatch world, there's some really strange stuff attached to these creatures. And not all of them may be physical animals. You know, they may be apparitional. They may, yeah. I mean, is it Greg and Dana Newkirk have suggested that some Sasquatch may be ghosts of something that used to exist.
Yes.
You know, there's all kinds of theories out there that could explain this phenomena. But again, you know, people get target locked on, you know, I'm trying to find a new species of animal, and completely disregard all of the other mysteries out there that, you know, if they looked at some of this stuff, they could go, oh, hey, you know, that might actually have something to do with the thing that I'm investigating too. So, yeah, and you'd see that too, you know, it's not just Sasquatch researchers. I don't want to pick on Sasquatch researchers. You
Yes.
see the same thing with UFO researchers. They don't believe in ghosts. They don't believe in Sasquatch. The ghost hunters are all like, I don't know about that whole Sasquatch thing, but you know, or you know, UFOs. It's like, I don't know. Yeah, you know, I don't know if I believe in that stuff. But all these people are investigating mysteries. It's like you'd think that they'd be like open-minded to this and say, hey, let's take a look at this stuff and see if it has any bearing on what we're investigating. But it doesn't seem to happen.
Well, it is. I mean, obviously, one of the key aspects of this book is looking at some well-known poltergeist cases. You've chosen one of my particular favorites, being a Yorkshireman, Travis, the Black Monk of Pontefract.
Oh, the black monk, yeah.
But you see this when people try to drill down into what causes the poltergeist phenomenon. For a lot of people, it is prepubescent or pubescent teenagers, mostly women, and you only have to read more than three or four books to realize, well, not all cases are like that. Some cases happen in very odd circumstances. Some cases happen in a solely male environment. Some cases involve young boys with no girls around at all. Some people are, there's no children involved. It's an old couple. It's a poltergeist infestation that lasts longer than the normal rule. Because apparently there is an unwritten rule that it only lasts 2 years. These kind of things, and you see them that they, it, oh, it's, well, it's something to do with puberty. It has to be. And yet you think, well, if you've got a poltergeist, one particular example off the top of my head, there was a famous case in the 1970s and early 80s here, Travis, about a industrial unit which was populated by men, lots of men, all in their 20s and 30s and 40s, and it was an industrial unit dealing with aluminium fittings, and they were having screws and bolts and all sorts flying around and whizzing. There wasn't a prepubescent child within a mile of that building. It was on an industrial estate. There was nowhere near. So straight away you've got, well, that's one case off the top of my head that says, well, that can't be the solution. And once again, when we talk about all kinds of strange phenomenon, it's not a one size fits all. It's not an all or nothing. Every explanation that you will very quickly, if you have a cast iron belief in one particular explanation of a phenomenon, you will very quickly either find a case that proves that wrong or ignore that case, and therefore mm-hmm. you are not a researcher, you are biased.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I love the Black Monk case, and I use the Black Monk case because it had it all.
Yes.
You know? I mean, and a lot of the phenomena that we see in the Black Monk case, and for those who aren't familiar, if you want to read about the Black Monk, Colin Wilson's book on poltergeists has a great section on that particular case. And he comments at the end of that section that he loves this case because it has it all. You know, it has and some things that he's not seen in other cases. But just real quick, so that people can get a general idea of what the forest poltergeist is about. In the Black Monk case, you know, we have rapping on the walls, right? So you get wood knocks. There's things flying around the house, which is very common in poltergeist cases, and things actually being thrown at people. Again, with the stone throwing. Stone throwing is a classic sign of the poltergeist phenomena. Guy Lyon Playfair talks about that in his book on the Enfield poltergeist.
Yes.
You know, he talks about a case in Brazil where they had a poltergeist outbreak. The young girl that was associated with this actually was they tried to have her exorcised by the Catholic Church. It just got worse. Mm-hmm. So the local spiritist person took her in. And during the course that he had this girl, during the course of time that he had this girl in his home, something like 200 plus stones rained down on his house. You know, so you want to talk about stone throwing, poltergeists are the world champs at it, right? And that was just one of the cases that I mentioned. You know, the rapping on wood thing is such a classic example of poltergeist phenomena that you know, you saw it in the early stages of the spiritualist movement.
Yes.
That was the first method of communication that the spirit supposedly had with the Fox sisters. I mentioned a case from Hans Holzer, the Luthold case, where the farmer and his wife in Switzerland are sitting in their home. They hear something knock on the door, go to the door. There's nobody there. They go back. They sit down. They're there for a little bit. Again, there's a knock on the door. There's nobody there. And finally, the wife gets wise and stations herself close to the door. There's a third knock on the door. She flings the door open. There's nobody there. But as she watches, a piece of wood drops to the ground in front of her. So whatever this force or phenomena was, it was using a piece of wood to knock on her door. So again, classic wood knocking thing. We talk about, you know, these cries in the woods and in Sasquatch cases. And, you know, poltergeists are known for making a wide variety of sounds. In the Black Monk case, they were making, the phenomena was making, barn animal sounds, in the living room at night. You know, and that's just one example of, you know, some of the many different sounds, voices and so forth that people have heard in poltergeist cases. You know, so, I mean, the Black Monk case is, it's got it all. There's, you know, there's a circumstance where one of the girl in the home was going up the stairs and actually got pinned down by furniture.
Yes.
And they couldn't get the furniture off of her until she stopped panicking.
Yeah.
I mean, there was all kinds of stuff happening in there. And it was very clear that this poltergeist was intent on rearranging its environment, which again, you know, we see the whole Class B Sasquatch thing with, oh, well, there's these tree structures and there's these nests and all this sort of stuff out in the woods. If you took all of this poltergeist phenomena that rearranges stuff and put it out in the woods, what do you think would happen? It'd probably make tree structures and nests and all kinds of other interesting things, right? There's one case in Wilson's book where a minister of some kind had a poltergeist outbreak where not only did this thing throw stuff around the house and shatter crockery, which was pretty standard poltergeist fare, but it also liked to arrange tableaus through the house.
Yes.
You know, they'd walk out of the room for 30 seconds and come back, and it would have taken, you know, garments and different things and made these little tableaus of like praying people and so forth.
Yeah.
It was just crazy. So this phenomena likes to rearrange its environment. And if you took the phenomena and you put it outside, what do you suppose you would get? You'd get tree structures, you'd get nests, you get all kinds of interesting stuff out in the woods. You know, people talk about tracks as the premier sign that there is a physical being here, you know, for the Sasquatch. But if you look at the history of poltergeists make tracks too. There's the case of the Bell Witch where, yes. The Bell Witch poltergeist actually made boot prints out in the snow, for the younger, Bell son, after his father died. In the Black Monk case, one of the manifestations in that particular case was puddles of water. They'd find puddles of water. They actually had the water turned off and had the town council people come in and look at the plumbing, and they couldn't find any problem with it at all, right?
Yeah.
Well, toward the end of the Black Monk case, the mom came down the stairs and noticed that the carpet runner that was leading up to the door was saturated with water, which, you know, they'd gotten used to this because, you know, they'd been dealing with it for over, I forget, that one went on for 2 or 3 years. It was saturated, and as she watched, footprints started to appear in the saturated carpet of the runner.
Yeah.
You know? So poltergeists make tracks. Yeah, it's one of the old standby ghost hunting techniques. Used to be putting, and still is, some people still do this, putting flour down on the floor in yeah. haunted areas to see if they could pick up footprints. There were footprints. There's a case that I mentioned in the book where it's a haunting case, but this woman encountered what appears to have been the ghost of the previous owner of her home. Practically had tea with this lady. they were out looking at the garden, and the woman commented that she loved the roses. And so this homeowner was going to give her some of the roses to take home with her. She got her pruning shears out, and she turned to do that. And when she turned back, this woman was gone. But there were tracks. this ghost left tracks behind. So, everybody wants to go, okay, well, you know, Sasquatch, you know, wood knocks. Poltergeist, knock on wood. Sasquatch, you know, stone throwing. Poltergeists love to throw things. They'll throw stones, they'll throw Lego bricks, they'll throw nuts and bolts like you were talking about, you know, whatever they can get their energies on, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the environmental changes, these tree structures and stuff can be closely paralleled in poltergeist lore. The tracks, again, closely paralleled in poltergeist lore. Vocalizations, same thing. I mean, you know, the poltergeist seems to be endlessly capable of making all kinds of interesting sounds. You know, in the Geth the Mongoose case, which, you know, when it first started out, this entity or phenomena, force, whatever you want to call it, was actually duplicating the hunting calls that the father was able to make. So, and I talk about an apparition case where the fellow was standing at a window and the apparition screamed so loud that it actually set him back on his heels. So, again, we have sounds and vocalizations and so forth associated with the poltergeist or haunting phenomena and with Sasquatch. There's a lot of parallel there, and I talk about that throughout the book.
I think it is, and it's mystifying to me because I love poltergeist cases. When I see some reports or I hear certain things, often, as you said, there is this perception, I don't know where it is, Travis, that, oh, well, if it's outside, it can't be a ghost. I mean, once again, it seems to be one of these things that people have decided without any sort of real energy to it. Because here in the UK, there's hundreds of haunted places that aren't houses and homes. We can't move for haunted battlefields here in the UK. North America is exactly the same. And I don't understand, once again, where people create these rules from. It's almost as if they can't deal with this concept, and therefore, as far as they're concerned, it can't possibly be true. Because, like you were saying about all these situations, I was speaking recently about Dogman with Chad Lewis, and one of the aspects of that we were talking about was the strange things that are happening on Lee Semple's farm, and he's got a prime example of these footprints that just stop in the middle of a field. And things like that, like you say, one of these wonderful old-fashioned part of the ghost hunter's kit was always a bag of flour to sprinkle on the floor because you were hoping you could catch something. But one of the most famous incidents in the modern era was the very strange case that happened in a little village called Doddleston here in the UK. And one of the early aspects of that was that foot and handprints were appearing on the walls, and they paint over them, and then they come back. And it clearly wasn't them, because they were in the shape of feet. And that was one of those, somebody went, oh, well, somebody's having a laugh. What do you mean? Somebody's having a laugh. You know, are they sort of jumping in the air? And because if you're going to be landing your foot halfway up a wall to lay a footprint on there, not only do you have to have something on your foot to leave a print, but you've also got to be wary of creating any damage, unless these people are specialized martial artists who are deciding to pull the chokes as Travis. Because once again, you start getting into the ludicrous explanation that just because it's real and it's got a physicality to it doesn't mean it's any less ludicrous. And so when you look at this, such as the stone throwing incidents, there was another famous incident here that happened in Birmingham, which involved the police, and they were staking it out, and essentially a collection of houses on a particular road, I think it was Thornton Road, Travis, were being bombarded regularly by very large pebbles. And when you say a pebble, people think you're talking maybe an inch or so, but these were, we were talking, you know, pretty hefty, the kind of pebbles you'd find on a seashore, sort of up to 6-7 inches wide, pretty hefty objects. You know, you'd really have to wang these to get them. And the police were staking out, they were hiding in people's gardens, in people's sheds. Nobody was ever caught, and people went, oh, well, it's somebody with a catapult. But once again, one of the other aspects, when we talk about, as you mentioned about Diane in the Pontefract case, being pinned to the stairs with objects which would normally have caused a serious harm, and yet she was completely unharmed. She was just held down by them. Is that not one person was injured by any of these pebbles and rocks being thrown at them? People were having their windows smashed. Mm-hmm. One woman had to have all the windows in the back of her house replaced. She reckoned, even then, this is like 40 years ago, she'd spent several thousand pounds replacing the glass that had been damaged. People had put wire up. The police had collected all these bricks. And there's a very famous interview. It was on Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World, I think. The episode's called Things That Go Bump in the Night, ironically. and the officer in charge of it had got a good, I don't know, 40 or 50 of these pebbles on his desk. And he was really annoyed, it seemed, that he couldn't work out what was going on. But they'd solved 5 murders in that time. So he was essentially saying it was easier to solve a murder when we didn't know who'd actually done it than it was to find out what was going on. And that, once again, was dismissed as a prankster with a catapult, even though,
sure,
I find it very hard to believe, with the greatest respect, if you're firing catapulted rocks into people's houses, somebody's going to get seriously hurt, whether you mean to do it or not. And nobody did.
Yep.
So it's the mischief aspect of it all, isn't it?
And the fun thing about poltergeists, too, is not only do they appear to be able to throw things that are in the environment, but they seem to be able to materialize things into the environment or take things in the environment that are locked away and get them out. The Black Monk case, again, and I keep referring back to that one because it really is kind of a, you know, it's like the case in, yes, in my book. I do talk about a couple of other things, but a couple of other cases. But it's one of the premier cases that I use for illustration in the book. in the Black Monk case, the poor mother was having trouble with the eggs actually appearing to apport themselves out of the refrigerator, fly through the air and explode.
Yeah.
And instead of, you know, being nauseous smelling or whatever, apparently they exploded into a sort of a fresh scent, you know.
Yes.
You know, because the poltergeist, depending on what mood it was in, depended on what kind of smells you got.
Yeah.
which is another thing that kind of associates to Sasquatch lore that I don't talk too much about. Mm. But, you know, I mean, what's one of the things that people will notice about Sasquatch is about 25% of the times is a foul smell, right?
Mm.
You get the same kind of things happening in poltergeist cases too. But anyway, mom got so irritated with this egg thing going on that she took the eggs out of the refrigerator, put them under a crate, and then sat on the crate. And the eggs were still coming out and exploding. You know, in some of these rock throwing cases, it wasn't clear whether the rocks were actually coming from the local environment or whether they were just appearing and falling on the roofs of houses. You know, so it just, and I forget where I was going with that, but, you know, it is the height of ludicrousness to me to insist that, you know, things like stone throwing and poltergeist cases are the result of a prankster with a catapult, because it's not just stones being thrown in most of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at the whole body of the case, there may be stones thrown in the house. There may be, you know, things moving around the house. You know, you have furniture that's pinning people to staircases, and, you know, you have all kinds of different phenomena happening in a poltergeist case, you know, and it's not just, and people will tend to lock on this one thing and say, oh, well, you know, it must be, you know, somebody using a catapult to throw stones. But how do you account for all the other weird things that happen in this house, you know, or, you know, in this area? The same way that, you know, when you have the stone throwing going on in the wilderness, you know, frequently that's not the only thing that happens. You may get calls. You may get wood knocks. You may get bipedal footsteps, which is another one of those things that's reported frequently in poltergeist cases and in Sasquatch cases. You know, all of these things. The problem that I think is that people get target locked on one thing.
Mm.
And they're like, okay, well, I can explain this. And so because they think they can explain that one thing, then they can just set their mind at ease about the rest of this stuff. It must all be, you know, just because stones may have been thrown by a prankster, you know, all of the phenomena associated with this case must therefore be a prank.
Yeah.
But how do you do, you know, like the case you mentioned, how do you make footprints on a wall? You know, even a skilled martial artist, you know, who, you know, might be able to make that jump and put a footprint on a wall if they had something on their foot, they have to land.
Yes.
You know?
Unless they land on their hands.
So where's the footprints on the floor? You know? Where's the footprints on the floor? I just, you know, I'm always amazed by skeptics who come up with these, you know, these interesting theories about how paranormal phenomena happen that really don't explain anything at all.
Yeah.
You know, and we talked about this back when we talked about my black dog book, you know, yes, where people are saying, well, it's just a large black dog and it, you know, it's unusually friendly and it comes up and follows people around. I'm like, yeah, but how do you explain the glowing eyes? You know, or the fact that somebody goes to pet one of these things and their hand goes right through it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, it does look like a physical, you know, like a very physical phenomena. This is something common in apparitions. But when you go to try to contact it, you can't. You can't put a hand on it. So, yeah, skeptics make me giggle sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you read some of those early flying saucer books too, and some of the explanations that scientists came up with for some of these UFOs. Oh, well, they saw the planet Venus. It's like, really? Okay, explain to me how Venus did triple loops in the sky.
I remember speaking to Preston Dennett about a particular UFO case.
Oh yeah.
And one of the witnesses was so scared about this object directly above her that she wet herself. And that was dismissed as her misidentifying Venus, even though it had moved to be directly above her. And I find it very hard to believe that a small dot of light in the sky would terrify a woman so much she would wet herself.
I completely concur with that idea. But yeah, I mean, I can understand somebody wetting themselves if they happen to wander across an 8-foot-tall bipedal primate in the woods. You know, that would make you wet yourself. But yeah, a pinpoint light in the sky? No, no. Yeah. Not unless there was something else going on there.
Hmm.
Yeah. And then we're probably not talking about a pinpoint light in the sky. We're probably talking about some kind of phenomena.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is often, like I said, the whole prankster excuse, be this whatever type of Fortean situation we're talking about, Travis, this always gets it. Yeah, Bigfoot, it's always hoaxes. It's always people running about. It's always people running about in hairy suits during hunting season that somehow don't get shot.
Yes.
It's always kids mucking about in poltergeist cases, even though you have incredible feats of strength and multiple witnesses seeing strange things. Oh, well, the kid happens to be the greatest illusionist that doesn't appear on television. You know, because we're talking about David Copperfield levels and David Blaine levels of illusion that we're supposed to believe. I mean, I've heard shows. I mean, Danny Robbins over here has done a brilliant podcast called Uncanny, where they investigate shows and they have a paranormal expert, usually the wonderful Evelyn Hollow, and they'll have a variety of skeptics who will explain things away. I've heard skeptics put forward an explanation that is then proved wrong, and they just ignore it as though nobody said anything, and they'll just carry on. Like the Battersea poltergeist, they were saying, oh, well, all the strange noises in the house you could put down to the underground. Well, they've measured that, and it was proved that wasn't the case. Nothing. Didn't register.
Yeah, but as far as they're concerned, once they put forward an explanation, they can brush their hands off and go on to the next thing, right? Yeah.
But it doesn't, like you say, it doesn't explain everything else. You can't say, the loud noises
are a train. It doesn't explain everything else. And, you know, the thing that really irritates me is that these people are doing these things in the name of science, and that's not science. If your hypothesis is disproven, then you have to develop another hypothesis. That's the way science is supposed to work.
Absolutely. You know,
not I developed a hypothesis and therefore I can go on to the next problem. That's not how it works.
No. You know? No.
That's not how it works at all. You know, ask anybody who actually does science for a living. But yeah, no, that whole business with the pranksters and Sasquatch, it's like there are any number of sightings in Sasquatch Canada, which is my last book, made by hunters. And in fact, there was one sighting where a young man claims to have actually shot one of these creatures and killed it. Of course, there's no body recovered. There's nothing like that, blah, blah, blah. You know, this kid was actually basically hunting without a license. And so, when he discovered that this creature was dead, he basically beat feet because he didn't want to get in trouble, right? But a lot of these sightings are made by people who are out in the woods with large caliber weapons intent on shooting something.
Yes.
Now, I don't know about you, but I think it's the height of insanity for anybody to want to go out in the woods in a ghillie suit or a gorilla suit or any of that kind of stuff and pretend to be a Sasquatch. Because it has happened in the United States that somebody's gotten shot for doing that.
Yeah,
it is, you know, particularly given the gun culture in the States. I mean, you're taking your life in your hands if you're doing a prank like that.
Yeah,
you know, because a lot of the people that see these creatures are hunters, and a lot of the people that are investigating these creatures go out armed. You know, in the United States, anyway. There's a certain group of people in Sasquatch, you know, research that believe that they really need to take a sample to prove to science that this creature exists. So they go out, they're basically gunning for Sasquatch. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but that's their take on the thing. And so, I mean, the idea that pranksters are running around in ghillie suits causing all of this mayhem, first of all, it's silly just given the extreme number of cases there are out there. I mean, if we're talking about pranksters, we're talking about a team of people that are spending their entire life doing this, and doing it in some of the most remote areas, yes. In the world, in the United States and Canada both, and the Himalayas and all the other places that these kinds of creatures are seen. It's just ludicrous to think that it's just pranksters.
Yeah.
So, that I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, it's a good point though, because recently, I don't know why this report has suddenly had more traction again, because it came out last year and this all happened last year. There was a study done by a scientist based here in Britain that basically correlated black bear populations and Bigfoot sightings, and basically said everybody's misidentifying a black bear. And you see, the thing about something like that, Travis, is you can straight away tell that they've gone into that study with the entire desire to say this is nonsense. Because if you get a Bigfoot sighting and you just say somebody saw a Bigfoot there and black bears live there, you can go, well, that's a black bear, they're wrong. But that's not what people say. People will say, well, it was doing this, it was doing that, it was this. I've been a hunter 30 years. I'm a professional game warden. I work for the Forestry Commission. There was no body of evidence other than somebody saw a Sasquatch. Therefore, I can say it's because there's no depth to that sighting. You're just basically comparing a sighting with a population. And therefore, you can essentially just make that study say what you want. And I found it incredible that somebody claiming to be a scientist has taken something and removed all the data that would make that presumption wrong out, because it didn't give them the result that they clearly wanted at the start of it. However, the odd thing about this study is that they couldn't explain away the sightings of skunk apes in Florida, because there's no black bear population there.
Just black bears down there.
So
yeah.
what are they trying to blame that on? Alligators?
Yeah, I guess it's the lizard man of Skateboard Swamp. He's just making a lot of appearances
moss.
All over Florida, right? Yeah, I read that study. I didn't read the study, but I read about the study. It's completely disingenuous, because the implication is, of course, that there are black bears, therefore all these people are misidentifying Sasquatch, and that's just sheer unmitigated crap.
Yeah.
Because we have, again, referring back to Sasquatch Canada, I had stories from people who were police officers, people who were hunters, who spent lots of time out in the brush. They know what a bear looks like.
Yep.
Native people here, they know what a bear looks like. They live with them all the time. They're not seeing bears.
Yeah.
They're seeing something different. Mm. My favorite story from that book was a gentleman that was in the Canadian forces, yes. Armed forces in Canada. This guy was a special operator. He was a special forces person who was out, his subspecialty was electronics, and he was out with a teammate, and they were looking for, this was back before the days of GPS. They were looking for the coordinates for this particular electronic device that they needed to maintain or fix. And his partner had a map spread out on the hood of their vehicle, and he was looking off at a cut line in the forest. I guess it was for power or whatever. And he saw a deer out there. So this guy not only is a trained, special operator, but he's also a hunter, right? So, observation times two. He sees a deer out in this cut. He watches as a Sasquatch bursts from the tree line, grabs this deer, snaps its neck, throws it over its shoulder, and disappears into the tree line before this guy can even say to his partner, "Hey, look, there's a."
Yeah.
Yeah, it was there and gone. He described that he actually served in Africa. He described the movement of this creature as being like a cheetah. It was so fast.
Mm.
Yeah, that's not a bear.
No.
You know? No. I mean, he saw this thing clearly. He knows what he saw. He testified to what he saw. But, you know, the implication from some scientist who's never investigated this phenomena at all, that this was a black bear, is just wrong.
Yeah.
Because this thing was twice the size of a black bear easily. Mm. Not to mention, you know, the method of hunting and so forth. Bears don't hunt that way.
No.
I mean, he took this thing, he just basically bulldogged it and snapped its neck and threw it over his shoulder and poof, gone. You know, so, which, you know, was one of those stories where you're thinking to yourself, there may be a physical creature out there, right?
Yeah.
But I just really, when I see stuff like that, it makes my blood boil, because it's just like you're telling thousands of witnesses, thousands of good witnesses who have experience in the woods and, you know, have hunted or, you know, been outdoors people or hiked or whatever. You're telling all of these people that they're mistaken because you can't believe that there might be an unknown species out there, or there might be something else weird going on out there. It's insulting. It's yes. insulting to the witnesses.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think the other aspect of this, and you touched on it a moment or two ago, is I think the other aspect of all this that often gets overlooked, especially in the modern pantheon of research, is the native tribal lore of such creatures. Mm-hmm. And there is a whole body of evidence that a lot of tribes and First Nations believe these creatures to be spiritual, Travis. They have, they seem to be more than flesh and blood. They are, some would consider them guardians of the forest, guardians of nature. And I think, once again, even with those people who have an interest in this subject and want to go out there with the best intentions, once again, this is another part of the whole Sasquatch enigma that gets overlooked, derided, ignored, and pushed to one side, because once again, mm-hmm. it doesn't fit in with the perception of the majority of people looking for Bigfoot.
Yeah. When you look at native lore, you have to be careful about, you know, the indigenous peoples of North America. You have to be careful of generalizations, but because, you know, one tribe may see Sasquatch as a particular kind of animal.
Mm.
The next tribe, Linda Godfrey mentions the Ho-Chunk, for instance,
yes.
believe that Sasquatch is basically an interdimensional being. It's something that exists on the other side and can come to our side and make itself physical while it's here. Mm. You know, other tribes have a more, as you say, spiritual belief in it. The Ojibwe up here have an ethical structure called the Seven Virtues, and each of those seven virtues is attached to an animal. And the virtue of honesty, if I remember correctly, is attached to Sabe, which is what we would call a Sasquatch. So they definitely believe that this creature exists in some way, shape, or form. Now, all of the other animals that they have assigned to these virtues are actual physical creatures like wolves and eagles and those kinds of things, right? So in their view, apparently Sasquatch is just another kind of animal. There are some tribes that seem to think that Sasquatch are actually people. They're the forest people, basically. They live out in the woods.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know, but yes, native lore, often, you know, the Lakota, for instance, you know, assign more kind of supernatural feel to the Sasquatch, but they also believe that there is something physical out there, because they report seeing them on the reservation all the time.
Yes.
And the South Dakota reservation area is not, you know, rife with trees and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a lot of place for a Sasquatch to hide. You know, we have reports from the prairies of Canada too, and Arizona, places where you wouldn't think that a large bipedal primate would be able to hide itself, but still, these things are appearing there.
Yes.
Now, whether it's an actual physical creature that these people are sighting, or whether there's something else going on, like this whole theory, that Sasquatch may walk between worlds, who knows? I don't know. That's why I love this stuff. It's a mystery. Mm. and it's just so much fun to read about these things, to read about these sightings, to read about some of the weird stuff that happens where, people see anomalous lights with Bigfoot and all that sort of thing. It's just endlessly interesting stuff.
I mean, well, it's very similar as well, because as you were saying there about the virtues and the creatures that are assigned to it, when people see petroglyphs and they say, oh, well, we've got an eagle and we've got a horse, mm-hmm. and we've got whatever, and then there'll be a Bigfoot there, and they go, well, that's a dream.
That's a mythic creature. Yeah, that's a mythical.
Because they don't believe that there's any possibility that such a creature can exist, therefore that can only be a dream. So it just shows you the power of such things, such as, I mean, even like the Chinese zodiac, Travis. Mm-hmm. Going on a slight tangent, there are 11 creatures that we are aware of, and the dragon.
And the dragon, yes.
So why have they got 11 creatures and a dragon? Is that saying that they just ran out of animals to use, which is patent nonsense, isn't it? And if they're if they're wanting it to be a mythical creature, then why did they only use one? Why didn't they use some of the other creatures from their legends? Why aren't there, why isn't one of the creatures a hopping vampire or such like? Why?
Mm-hmm. Or the fox fae.
Yes.
I don't know what they call them in China, but they're kitsune in Japan.
Yes.
There's a very similar type of being in China, and I can't recall the name of it off the top of my head. But, there's all kinds of legendary creatures in Chinese and Japanese lore. Why dragons and not, because you got rats and horses and tigers and all this other stuff in the Chinese zodiac, and then you got dragons.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be like if you had rats and horses and tigers and so forth, and then you had, the Yeren.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a Chinese version of Sasquatch.
Yeah. But you see this kind of excuse or sort of taking control of the indigenous population's legends and lore, as we've touched on several times when we're talking about the dogman. And you'll see people go, oh, well, what people are seeing is a skinwalker. Which shows a complete lack of knowledge about the skinwalker.
Oh, don't get me going on that.
and also the fact that the skinwalker is essentially ingrained with the Navajo culture. Mm-hmm. The Navajo were not based in Wisconsin.
No.
So why would a Navajo creature, which is often not just a wolf or a dog type creature, it's a bear, it's an eagle, it's whatever that person wants to be. Mm-hmm. Why would it be, turn up in Wisconsin? Why is it not running around where the Navajo are based? It's one of those things, I think, in the modern era that people grab onto an explanation. Even as we were saying, we always criticize skeptics for ludicrous explanations. And yet in the paranormal, we sometimes ignore people putting forward as equally nonsensical explanations for strange things, because they've got an extremely limited knowledge about something they're trying to explain, mm-hmm. in their worldview of the weird.
The skinwalker thing makes me nuts. Yeah. Absolutely nuts. I lived in Arizona for 13 years. I have some familiarity with Navajo lore. And I know that, and I wouldn't even try to pronounce it Navajo. It has a very specific name. It has a very specific set of myths and legends behind it. It has a very specific lore. And it is indigenous to the Navajo people.
Yep.
And possibly the Utes.
Yes.
There seems to be some cross culturation there. Mm. But the stories of skinwalkers are very specific, and they are not dogmen.
No.
The skinwalker is capable of, you know, according to the lore, is capable of converting to a number of different types of animals. Bears and wolves and coyotes and those kinds of things seem to be most common. But, you know, it's not a case of something that, you know, there's also the stories from the res of people being chased by something that's able to keep up with their car, that has a sort of a dog man kind of look to it. But basically, it's more about, you know, the impression that people give is that this is a person with an animal skin on and glowing eyes, which is kind of a, you know, this is a skinwalker type of report. And these beings, these people will run alongside of cars and scare the bejabbers out of people in the middle of the night, right? Yeah, I know if I saw one of these things, I'd be out of there too.
Yes.
But it's not a dog man. It is not a dog man. you know, there are examples of shapeshifters in a number of native cultures. And, you know, in addition to the European werewolf myths and those kinds of things, I mean, there are probably indigenous stories that could account for this creature, but it's not a skinwalker.
No.
A skinwalker is a completely different thing. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, just because people have seen weird things on a ranch and people have latched onto that name doesn't mean that everything paranormal is now a skinwalker any more than it means that everything paranormal is now a Sasquatch or a UFO or, you know, djinn or whatever.
Yeah.
Just we need, before we latch onto these ideas, to do some research.
Yes.
And look at some of the classic texts that, you know, from the anthropologists that lived and studied with the Navajo.
Yes.
To find out what a skinwalker is before we go and stick our foot in our mouth.
Well, we won't, but there's plenty of people that will do it for us. Mm-hmm. I suppose the other potential explanation, or one of them, as we stress, this is not a, it is one thing or the other here, Travis, about all this, is the Fae.
Oh, yeah.
The ultimate trickster. Once again, here we have a concept that spans the globe from all cultures, from all parts of history. The Fae seem to be entwined with all kinds of strange things. Some of the behavior that we discover in Class B, once again, same as poltergeist as well. You can often find a lot of parallels with the Fae in that kind of mischievous cheekiness.
Yeah, so there's a whole chapter in the book about the Fae as a possible explanation for my forest poltergeist, because there is so much cross-referencing in the lore between the Fae and poltergeists, and the Fae having causing, you know, disturbances in the woods, in the wilderness, right? You know, take for example, you want to talk about the Fae and poltergeist, take for example the brownie, right? There's a story in the book about I think it's from oh my goodness, my brain just fell out of my head. The famous fairy folklorist, whose name I can't recall. It'll jump back into my head here in a minute. But she talks of a story of a brownie. Brownies normally in most of the lore are helpful spirits.
Yes.
But if you tick one off, then you're in trouble. So in this particular case, this brownie was helping this farmer with threshing corn. That was kind of its thing. And one of the farmhands made some comment about how, you know, the brownie wasn't doing its job right, and that, you know, the threshing wasn't as well done as it normally was. Well, apparently this little being took exception to that. And, you know, and you had an outbreak of what would most people would characterize as poltergeist phenomena, with knocking and banging and, you know, basic stomping around the house, which culminated in this farmer's entire corn crop being dumped over a cliff about 2 miles away. So, yeah, we certainly could make the case that, you know, that the Fae are responsible for some of these disturbances that people are encountering. I would particularly think that, you know, the Fae are known for claiming certain areas. You know, whether it's a castle or a fairy ring out in the woods, or a particular grove of trees, or, you know, I mean, you can go on and on and on. A bridge, a river, you know, any of those kinds of things can be places where these beings will manifest themselves. Mm-hmm. And if a human being happens to stumble into one of the areas that have been claimed by these beings, I can certainly see, you know, rock throwing and tree knocking and bipedal footsteps and basic throwing around of things as being a way that that these beings might try to scare somebody out of the woods. Not to mention, you know, if you look at the work of Morgan Daimler, for instance, who's the fairy folklorist par excellence these days.
Yes.
You know, she talks about I think it was 21st Century Fairy, the harmful things that the Fae are known for, as well as the blessings of these beings. And, you know, some of these harmful things fall very firmly into the poltergeist camp. Mm-hmm. You know, and if I had to choose a class of beings that I really wouldn't want to tick off, they're high on my list. Because, you know, you earn the enmity of the Fae, and it's very, very difficult to negotiate a truce. So, you know, they're going to drive you out of wherever it is they want to get rid of you from. And, you know, for those people who don't think that these things exist, that this is all folklore and stuff, I mean, yeah, okay, fine. Read something like, you know, read some of Morgan Daimler's books for one thing. If I recall, she's coming out with a book of 21st century fairy encounters.
Yes.
Here soon. I just wish I could remember the name of this folklorist that I've been trying to recall for the past 5 minutes now. But Catherine Briggs.
Oh, Catherine Briggs. I'm going to say the other one. I think I was Janet Board.
Yeah. Well, and then Janet Board also has a book out about fairy encounters.
Yes.
Actual live people saw these beings out there. So, you know, we can't discount anything. My point throughout this entire book is we cannot discount anything. You know, there are human causes that may account for some of these things. There are spiritual causes like the Fae. There may actually be a bipedal primate out there. You know, and all of these things could help to explain some of the encounters that, you know, people are having out in the woods. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, yeah, a certain number of the things are just people being jumpy in the forest.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the woodland, if you're not familiar with it, can be a scary place. But not all of them, because a lot of these things happen to people who are very experienced outdoors people, you know, or hunters, or, you know, as I say, police officers and, you know, our folks that are in the armed forces and so forth. So, you know, we need to look at all the reasons. You know, I talk about the Philip experiment in the book. Yes. I talk about the theory of, you know, recurring spontaneous psychokinesis, which is what you were talking about earlier, where there is a focus to the poltergeist phenomena. You know, some of the disturbances that are happening out in the woods could actually be caused by people themselves.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, frustrated Sasquatch researchers could be causing some of this stuff to happen themselves.
Yes.
You know, if we buy into this theory of RSPK, where repressed emotion can come out as what Lloyd Auerbach calls a psychic temper tantrum.
Yes.
It could happen. It's entirely possible. We know that PK actually exists on a micro scale just from laboratory experiments. So, you know, who's to say that certain people don't have more of a talent for it? And, you know, when, maybe they're not conscious of that, but if they're repressing emotion or you know, very emotional about something, maybe that talent comes out as a sort of a wild talent and causes disturbances in that area. You know, there's all kinds of things that could account for some of these disturbances in the woods. It doesn't all have to be, you know, the bipedal primate stomping around and, you know, leaving tracks and doing, you know, wood knocks and so forth.
Absolutely. And I think, as I said earlier in the conversation, Travis, the one thing that this book is clearly is written in the perspective of a very open mind, which shows when we try and unpick some of these explanations that come forward from all walks of life on both sides of the argument, often they, regardless of what they may say, they are coming from a closed perspective in regards to what they believe is going on. And I think the one thing that you can garner by reading this book is, if you still have the same opinion at the start of the book as you do after reading it, I suggest it's probably not the book for you.
Yeah, well, I would suggest, you know, that if you don't encounter anything in that book that makes you think, either you're already a Fortean and you're already super open-minded, yeah, or your mind is just closed to this idea completely, and, you know, nothing I or anybody else can say is going to change your mind. You know, and again, you know, I keep stressing this, but I do want to make it clear to all the people who are interested in Sasquatch out there, I do not discount the idea that there is a physical creature out there. My problem is that, you know, we have sightings in all of the 48 contiguous states and Alaska. The only place that there haven't been sightings is Hawaii, and they have their own Littlefoot, the Minnehuna, so which is more of a fairy creature, but still, yes, described in sort of similar manner. You know, so we have sightings in all the 48 contiguous states, plus Alaska, all of the provinces of Canada, except perhaps none of it. And that's just because I couldn't find any sightings out there. There's literally thousands and thousands of sightings of these creatures in places all over North America and in places where a large bipedal primate is going to have trouble hiding.
Yep.
You know, again, like I said, Arizona, you know, the South Dakota Badlands, places like that. Oklahoma. I mean, there are sightings in Oklahoma. Now, in the Davis Mountains, I could see that, but there's a lot of Oklahoma that's pretty much flat plains. There's not a lot of places to hide. You know, so there's theories that, oh, they're following the rivers and the forests along the rivers. That's not much space for a large primate to operate in. you know, they're everywhere. And not only that, but these Class B encounters, there's probably, you know, twice as many of those as there are actual sightings. So for a creature that one would assume is fairly rare, you know, how is it that Sasquatch is manifesting itself all over North America? Yeah. I think there has to be something more going on,
yeah,
than just a bipedal primate, you know, making itself known, you know, on rare occasions. You know, if we were only seeing sightings in, you know, wilderness areas, thickly forested wilderness areas and so forth up in, you know, Canada and the Pacific Northwest and some other places in the United States, maybe the Adirondacks, that would be one thing. But given the distribution that we're seeing, I think that you have to start looking at other causes for some of these sightings and some of these Class B encounters. And that's where the forest poltergeist and some of the theories in that book come in. You know, I'm not saying that it is a be all and end all. You know, this is all the theories about everything. But it'll get you thinking. And there's plenty of stuff in the bibliography for people who want to follow up on that.
No, I think it's a fantastic addition, as you refer to there, Travis. It's a book that looks at a variety of things and proves that too often it's not black or white. There's a lot of grey when it comes to this particular thing. And it's either being forced into boxes that it can't fit in, or it's either being ignored or just dismissed out of hand. And I think reading your book as simply solidified some of the thoughts I've been developing over the last 2 or 3 years, and proving that even though sometimes I get frustrated with myself, Travis, I do actually have an open mind, and it's continuing to get bigger.
Yeah, you can't hang out in this space for any length of time and not have your mind either, you know, have to clamp shut because you can't deal, or you just keep expanding what you, you know, the things that you think might be happening. So yeah, I mean, this is a, you know, the thing about these phenomena is that the more you dig into them, the more you realize that there's so much stuff going on out there. And, yeah, I mean, you just read the work of Charles Fort and you see all kinds of interesting other things besides Sasquatch and UFOs and hauntings and so forth. You know, you've got things that are falling from the sky and all kinds of other interesting weirdness. You know, when I talk about Sasquatch, though, you know, I recommend that people kind of read both books and
yeah,
you know, Sasquatch Canada and the Forest Poltergeist, because Sasquatch Canada's got some really interesting sightings in it, Class A sightings, visual sightings of Sasquatch, and it's got a chapter called Strange Things, which accounts for some of the stranger Sasquatch sightings of Canada. Yes. So it's kind of a good primer for going into the Forest Poltergeist, which is a little more general.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on another fabulous book, Travis. Where can everybody get hold of a copy and keep up to date with what you've got going on next, no doubt?
So The Forest Poltergeist is available on Amazon. As always, it's available both as a paperback and as a Kindle edition. If you happen to be a Kindle Unlimited member, then you can read it for free, which can't beat that, right?
Yep.
And then, so explore Amazon. I'm pretty sure that it should be available on Amazon UK. My other books have been, so yeah. Okay. That's good to know. As far as keeping track of me, you can actually follow me WT Watson author page on Facebook, or if you want to follow me personally, it's Will Watson, and you can, they have the same profile picture, so it's pretty easy to pick out which one is me. I'm also on Twitter at WTWatson2, and I'm on Instagram, although I'm still trying to figure out how to use that platform. Some days it's easier than others.
Yes.
My handle there is Couriner, Couriner60. So that's the easiest ways to get hold of me. I'm always happy to hear from people if you, you know, have comments or questions or whatever about books or, sighting reports, any of that kind of stuff. I don't get a lot of that sort of thing happening, but every once in a while somebody comes up and says, hey, and those are always interesting.
Brilliant. Well, thank you as always. It's always a pleasure speaking with you and spending some time in your company and picking over some various thoughts. And, I always enjoy reading your work, Travis. You've quickly become one of my favorite authors, primarily because often you do challenge some of the preconceived ideas I try to pretend I don't have. And so I will always thank you for that. And I look forward to your next project. No doubt you're already beavering away on pulling something together going forwards.
I'm taking a little break right now. I realized this past year that, or this over the holiday season, that I put out, let's see, five nonfiction books since 2019.
Yeah.
Plus the novel. So,
yeah.
I'm taking a little space right now to brain recuperate and, you know, get, settled in a new job. And once I do that, I've got a couple of ideas in mind. So I won't be too long before I get another one out there.
Brilliant. Well, I look forward to our next conversation, and hopefully I'll make sure I get your email if whichever supernatural entity decided to block the last correspondence. But yeah, we got there in the end. So thank you as always, my friend. It's been a real pleasure as always.
It's always a pleasure talking with you, Paul. Thank you very much.